There was this to be said about Cohen. If there was no reason for him to kill you, such as you having any a large amount of treasure or being between him and somewhere he wanted to get to, then he was good company. Rincewind had met him a few times before, generally while running away from something. Cohen didn't bother over much with questions. As far as Cohen was concerned, people appeared, people disappeared. After a 5-year gap, he'd just say, "Oh, it's you." He never added, "And how are you?" You were alive, you were upright, and beyond that he didn't give a damn. It was a lot warmer beyond the mountains. To Rincewind's relief, a spare horse didn't have to be eaten because a leopardly sort of creature dropped off a tree branch and tried to disembowel Cohen. It had a rather strong flavour. Rincewind had eaten horse. Over the years he'd nerved himself to eat anything that couldn't actually wriggle off his fork. But he was feeling shaken enough without eating something you could call Dobbin. "How did they catch you?" he said when they were riding again.
"Oh, I was busy."
"Cohen the Barbarian? Too busy to fight?"
"I didn't want to upset the young lady. Couldn't help myself. Went down to a village to pick up some news. One thing led to another. Next thing, a load of soldiers were all over the place like cheap armour. And I can't fight that well with me arms shackled behind me back. Real nasty bugger in charge. Face I won't forget in a hurry. Half a dozen of us were rounded up, made to push the barking dog thing all the way out here. Then we were chained to that tree, and someone lit the bit of string, and they all legged it behind a snowdrift. Except you came along and vanished it."
"I didn't vanish it. Not exactly, anyway." Cohen leaned across towards Rincewind.
"I reckon I know what it was," he said, and sat back, looking pleased with himself.
"Yes?"
"I reckon it was some kind of firework. They're very big on fireworks here."
"You mean the sort of things where you light the blue touch paper and stick it up your nose?"
"Kids. Only very silly wizards with bad sinus trouble do this. Sensible people go off to a roped-off enclosure where they can watch a heavily protected man in the middle distance light with the aid of a very long pole something that goes pfft, and then they can shout hooray."
"They use them to drive evil spirits away. There's lots of evil spirits, see? Because of all the slaughtering."
"Slaughtering?" Rincewind had always understood that the Agatean Empire was a peaceful place. It was civilized. They invented things. In fact, he recalled, he'd been instrumental in introducing a few of their devices to Ankh-Morpork. Simple, innocent things like clocks worked by demons and boxes that painted pictures and extra glass eyes you could wear over the top of your own eyes to help you see better, even if it did mean you made a spectacle of yourself. It was supposed to be dull.
"Oh, yeah. Slaughtering," said Cohen. "Like, supposing the population is being a bit behind with its taxes. You pick some city where people are being troublesome and kill everyone and set fire to it and pull down the walls and plough up the ashes. That way you get rid of the trouble and all the other cities are suddenly really well-behaved and polite and all your back taxes turn up in a big rush, which is handy for governments, I understand. Then if they ever give trouble, you just have to say, 'Remember Nang Nang?' or whatever. And they say, 'Where's Nang Nang?' And you say, 'My point exactly.'"
"Good grief. If that sort of thing was tried back home..."
"Ah, but this place has been going a long time. People think that's how a country is supposed to run. They do what they're told. The people here are treated like slaves."
Cohen scowled.
"Now, I've got nothing against slaves, you know, as slaves. Owned a few in my time. Been a slave once or twice. But where the slaves, what do you expect to find?"
Rincewind thought about this. "Whips?" he said at last.
"Yeah, got it in one. Whips. There's something honest about slaves and whips. Well, they ain't got whips here. They got something worse than whips."
"What?" said Rincewind, looking slightly panicky.
"You'll find out."
Rincewind found himself looking around at the half-dozen other prisoners who had trailed after them and were watching in awe from a distance. He'd given them a bit of leopard, which they'd looked at initially as if it was poison, and then eaten as if it was food. "They're still following us," he said.
"Yeah, well, you did give them meat," cackled Cohen, starting to roll a post-prandial cigarette. "Shouldn't have done that. Should have let them have the whiskers and the claws, and then you'd been amazed what they'd cook up. You know their big dish down on the coast?"
"No."
"Pig's ear soup. Now, what's that tell you about a place, eh?"
Rincewind shrugged. Very provident people?
Some other bugger pinches the pig.
He turned in the saddle. The group of ex-prisoners shrank back.
Now see here, he said. I told you, you're free. Understand?
One of the braver men spoke up.
Yes, master.
I ain't your master. You're free. You can go whenever you like. Excepting if you follow me, I'll kill the lot of you. And now, go away.
Where, master?
Anywhere. Somewhere not here.
The men gave one another some worried looks, and then the whole group, as one man, turned and trotted away along the path.
Probably go straight back to their village, he said, rolling his eyes. Worse than whips, I tell you.
He waved a scrawny hand at the landscape as they rode on.
Strange bloody country, he said. Did you know there's a wall all round the empire?
That's to keep the barbarian invaders out.
Oh, yes, very defensive, said Cohen sarcastically. Like, oh my goodness, there's a 20-foot wall, dear me, I suppose we'd just better ride off back over 1,000 miles of steppe and not, e.g., take a look at the ladder possibilities inherent in that pine wood over there. No, it's to keep people in.
And rules?
They've got rules for everything. No one even goes to the privy without a piece of paper.
Well, as a matter of fact, I myself...
A piece of paper saying they can go is what I meant. Can't leave your village without a chit. Can't get married without a chit. Can't even have a sh...
Oh, here we are. Yes, indeed, said Rincewind. Cohen glared at him. How did you know? He demanded. Rincewind tried to think. It had been a long day. In fact, it had, because of the thalmic equivalent of jet lag, been several hours longer than most other days he'd experienced, and had contained 2 lunchtimes, neither of which had contained anything worth eating. I thought you were making a general philosophical point, he hazarded. Like, we'd better make the best of it.
I meant we're at my hideout, said Cohen.
Rincewind stared around them. There were scrubby bushes, a few rocks, and a sheer cliff face. I can't see anything, he said.
Yep. That's how you can tell it's mine.
The art of war was the ultimate basis of diplomacy in the Empire. Clearly, war had to exist. It was a cornerstone of the processes of government. It was the way the Empire got its leaders. The competitive examination system was how it got its bureaucratic and public officials, and warfare was for its leaders, perhaps, only a different kind of competitive examination. Admittedly, if you lost, you probably weren't allowed to resit next year. But there had to be rules. Otherwise, it was just a barbaric scuffle. So, hundreds of years ago, the art of war had been formulated. It was a book of rules. Some were very specific. There was to be no fighting within the Forbidden City. The person of the Emperor was sacrosanct. And some were more general guidelines for the good and civilized conduct of warfare. There were the rules of position, of tactics, of the enforcement of discipline, of the correct organization of supply lines. The art laid down the optimum course to take in every conceivable eventuality. It meant that warfare in the Empire had become far more sensible and generally consisted of short periods of activity followed by long periods of people trying to find things in the index. No one remembered the author. Some said it was one Tzu Sung. Some claimed it was three Sun Sung. Possibly it was even some unsung genius who had penned, or rather painted, the very first principle, know the enemy and know yourself. Lord Hong felt that he knew himself very well, and seldom had trouble knowing his enemies, and he made a point of keeping his enemies alive and healthy. Take the Lords Sung, Fang, Tang and McSweeney. He cherished them. He cherished their... adequacy. They had adequate military brains, which was to say that they had memorized the 5 rules and 9 principles of the art of war. They wrote adequate poetry, and were cunning enough to counter such coups as were attempted in their own ranks. They occasionally sent against him assassins who were sufficiently competent to keep Lord Hong interested and observant and entertained. He even admired their adequate treachery. No one could fail to realize that Lord Hong would be the next emperor, but when it came to it, they would nevertheless contest the throne. At least officially. In fact, each warlord had privately pledged his personal support to Lord Hong, being adequately bright to know what was likely to happen if he didn't. There would still have to be a battle, of course, for custom's sake, but Lord Hong had a place in his heart for any leader who would sell his own men. Know your enemy. Lord Hong had decided to find a worthwhile one, so Lord Hong had seen to it that he got books and news from Ankh Morpork. There were ways. He had his spies. At the moment, Ankh Morpork didn't know it was the enemy, and that was the best kind of enemy to have. And he had been amazed, and then intrigued, and finally lost in admiration for what he saw. "I should have been born there," he thought, as he watched the other members of the Serene Council. "Oh, for a game of chess with someone like Lord Vetinari. No doubt he would carefully watch the board for 3 hours before he even made his first move." "Can we get on?" he said. The man licked his brush nervously. "Nearly finished, O Lord," he said. Lord Hong sighed. Damn calligraphy. There would be changes. A written language of 7,000 letters, and it took all day to write a 13-syllable poem about a white pony trotting through wild hyacinths. And that was fine and beautiful, he had to concede, and no one did it better than Lord Hong. But Ankh Morpork had an alphabet of 26 unexpressive, ugly, crude letters, suitable only for peasants and artisans, and had produced poems and plays that left white-hot trails across the soul. And you could also use it to write the bloody minutes of a 5-minute meeting in less than a day.
"How far have you got?"
he said. The eunuch coughed politely.
"How softly the bloom of the apricot," he began.
"Yes, yes, yes," said Lord Hong. "Could we on this occasion dispense with the poetic framework, please?"
"Ah, the minutes of the last meeting were duly signed."
"Is that all?"
"Ah, you see, I have to finish painting the petals on—"
"I wish this council to be concluded by this evening. Go away."
The eunuch looked anxiously around the table, grabbed his scrolls and brushes, and scuttled out.
"Good," said Lord Hong.
He nodded at the other warlords. He saved a special, friendly nod for Lord Tang. Lord Hong had prodded the thought with some intrigued interest, but it really did seem that Lord Tang was a man of honour. It was a rather cowed and crabbed honour, but it was definitely in there somewhere, and would have to be dealt with.
"It would be better in any case, my lords, if we spoke in private," he said. "On the matter of the rebels, disturbing intelligence has reached me of their activities."
Lord McSweeney nodded.
"I have seen to it that 30 rebels in Sum Dim have been executed," he said, "as an example."
"As an example of the mindlessness of Lord McSweeney," thought Lord Hong.
To his certain knowledge, and none had better knowledge than he, there had not even been a cadre of the Red Army in Sum Dim. But almost certainly there was one now. It was really too easy. The other warlords also made small but proud speeches about their efforts to turn barely noticeable unrest into bloody revolution, although they hadn't managed to see it like that. They were nervous, under the bravado, like sheepdogs who'd had a glimpse of the world where the sheep did not run. Lord Hong cherished their nervousness. He intended to use it by and by. He smiled and smiled. Finally, he said,
"However, my lords, despite your sterling efforts, the situation remains grave. I have information that a very senior wizard from Ankh Morpork has arrived to assist the rebels here in Hung Hung, and that there is a plot to overthrow the good organization of the celestial world and assassinate the emperor. May he live for 10,000 years. I must naturally assume that the foreign devils are behind this."
"I know nothing of this," snapped Lord Tang.
"My dear Lord Tang, I was not suggesting that you should," said Lord Hong.
"I meant—" Lord Tang began.
"Your devotion to the emperor is unquestioned,"
Lord Hong continued, as smoothly as a knife through warm butter.
"It is true that there is almost certainly someone highly placed assisting these people, but no one shred of evidence points to you."
"I should hope not."
Indeed.
The Lords Fang and McSweeney moved very slightly away from Lord Tang.
How can we have let this happen? Said Lord Fang. Certainly it is true that people, foolish, deranged people, have sometimes ventured out beyond the wall, but to let one come back...
I am afraid the Grand Vizier at the time was a man of changeable humours, said Lord Hong. He thought it would be interesting to see what intelligence was brought back.
Intelligence, said Lord Fang. The city of Ankh Moor Pork is an abomination, mere anarchy. There appear to be no nobles of consequence, and the society is that of a termite nest. It would be better for us, my lords, if it was wiped from the face of the world.
Your incisive comments are duly noted, Lord Fang, said Lord Hong,
while part of him rolled on the floor laughing.
In any event, he went on, I shall see that extra guards are posted in the Emperor's chambers. However all this trouble began, we must see that it ends here.
He watched them, watching him.
They think I want to rule the Empire, he thought.
So they're all, except for Lord Tang, rebel fellow traveller as he will undoubtedly prove to be, working out how this will be to their advantage. He dismissed them and retired to his chambers. It was a fact that the ghosts and devils who lived beyond the wall had no grasp of culture, and certainly no concept of books, and being in possession of such a patently impossible object was punishable by eventual death and confiscation. Lord Hong had built up quite a library. He had even acquired maps, and more than maps. There was a box he kept locked in the room with the full-length mirror. Not now, later on. Ankh Moor Pork. Even the name sounded rich. All he needed was a year. The dreadful scourge of the rebellion would allow him to wield the kind of powers that even the maddest emperor had not dreamed of. And then it would be unthinkable not to build a vengeful fleet to wreak terror on the foreign devils. Thank you, Lord Fang. Your point is duly noted. As if it mattered who was emperor. The empire was possibly a bonus to be acquired later, perhaps, in passing. Let him just have Ankh Moor Pork with its busy dwarfs and its grasp, above all, of machinery. Look at the barking dogs. Half the time they blew up. They were inaccurate. The principle was sound, but the execution was terrible, especially when they blew up. It had come as a revelation to Lord Hong when he looked at the problem the Ankh Moor Pork way and realized that it might just possibly be better to give the job of auspicious dog-maker to some peasant with a fair idea about metal and explosive earths than to some clerk who'd got the highest marks in an examination to find the best poem about iron. In Ankh Moor Pork, people did things. Let him just walk down Broadway as owner and eat the pies of the famous Mr. Dibbler. Let him play one game of chess against Lord Vetinari. Of course it would mean leaving the man one arm. He was shaking with excitement. Not later, now. His fingers reached for the secret key on its chain around his neck. It was barely a track. Rabbits would have walked right past it. And you'd have sworn there was a sheer passless rock wall until you found the gap. Once you did find it, it was hardly worth the bother. It led to a long gully with a few natural caves in it, and a bit of grass and a spring. And as it turned out, Cohen's gang. Except that he called it a horde. They were sitting in the sun, complaining about how it wasn't as warm as it used to be.
"I'm back then, lads," said Cohen.
"Been away, have you?"
"What? What's he say?" "He said he's back." "Black what?"
Cohen beamed at Rincewind.
"I brought them with me," he said. "Like I said, no future in going it alone these days."
Said Rincewind, after surveying the little scene, "are any of these men under 80 years old?"
"Stand up, boy Willie," said Cohen.
A dehydrated man, only marginally less wrinkled than the others, got to his feet. It was his feet that were particularly noticeable. He wore boots with extremely thick soles.
"So's me feet touch the ground," he said.
"Don't they, touch the ground in ordinary boots?"
"Nope. Orthopaedic problem, see? Like, you know how a lot of people got one leg shorter than the other? Funny thing, with me, it's
"Don't tell me," said Rincewind. "Sometimes I get these amazing flashes. Both legs are shorter than the other, right?"
"Amazing. Of course, I can see you're a wizard," said Boy Willie. "You'd know about this sort of thing."
Rincewind gave the next member of the horde a bright, mad smile. It was almost certainly a human being, because wizened little monkeys didn't usually go around in a wheelchair while wearing a helmet with horns on. It grimaced at Rincewind.
"This is..." "What? What?" "Mad Hamish," said Comyn. "What? Who's he?"
"I bet that wheelchair terrifies them," said Rincewind, "especially the blades."
"We had the devil of a job getting it over the wall," Comyn conceded. "But you'd be amazed at his turn of speed." "What?"
"And this is Truckle, the uncivil."
"Sod off, wizard."
Rincewind beamed at Exhibit B. "Those walking sticks, fascinating. Very impressive the way you've got love and hate written on them." Comyn smiled proprietorially.
"Truckle used to be reckoned one of the biggest badasses in the world," he said.
"Really? Him?"
"But it's amazing what you can do with a herbal suppository."
"Up yours, mister," said Truckle.
Rincewind blinked.
Can I have a word, Comyn?"
He drew the ancient barbarian aside.
"I don't want to seem to be making trouble here," he said. "But it doesn't strike you, does it, that these men are a bit, well, past their sell-by date? A little, not to put too fine a point on it, old?"
"What? What's he seeing?" "He says it's cold." "What?"
"What are you saying? There's nearly 500 years of concentrated barbarian hero experience in 'em," said Comyn.
500 years' experience in a fighting unit is good," said Rincewind.
"It's good, but it should be spread over more than one person.
I mean, what are you expecting them to do? Fall over on people?"
"Nothing wrong with them," said Comyn, indicating a frail man who was staring intently at a large block of teak. "Look at old Caleb the Ripper over there. See? Killed more than 400 men with his bare hands. 85 now, and but for the dust, he's marvellous."
"What the hell is he doing?"
"Ah, see? They're into bare-handed combat here. Very big thing, unarmed combat, on account of most people not being allowed weapons. So Caleb reckons he's onto a good thing. See that big lump of teak? It's amazing. He just gives this blood-curdling shout, and..."
"Comyn, they're all very old men."
"They're the cream,"
Rincewind sighed. "Comyn, they're the cheese. Why have you brought them all the way here?"
"Gonna help me steal something," said Comyn.
"What, a jewel or something?"
"It's something," said Comyn sulkily. "It's in Hung Hung."
"Really, my word," said Rincewind, "and there's a lot of people in Hung Hung, I expect."
"About 500,000, said Comyn.
"Lots of guards, no doubt."
"About 40,000, I heard. About 750,000, if you count all the armies."
"Right," said Rincewind. "So with these half-dozen old men..."
"The Silver Horde," said Comyn, with a touch of pride.
"What? Pardon?"
"That's their name. Got to have a name in the Horde business. The Silver Horde."
Rincewind turned around. Several of the Horde had fallen asleep.
"The Silver Horde," he said. "Right. Matches the colour of their hair. Those that have got hair. So, with this Silver Horde, you're going to rush the city, kill all the guards, and steal all the treasure."
Comyn nodded.
"Yeah, something like that. Of course, we won't have to kill all the guards."
"Oh, no?"
"It'd take too long."
"Yes, and of course you'll want to leave something to do tomorrow."
"I mean, they'll be busy, what with the revolution and everything."
"A revolution, too, my word."
"They say it's a time of portents," said Comyn.
"I'm surprised they've got time to worry about the state of their camping equipment," said Rincewind.
"You'd be well advised to stay along with us," said Genghis Comyn. "You'd be safer with us."
I'm not sure about that," said Rincewind, grinning horribly. "I'm not sure about that at all." "By myself," he thought. "Only ordinary horrible things can happen to me." Comyn shrugged, and then stared around the clearing until his gaze lighted on a slight figure who was sitting a little apart from the rest, reading a book.
"Look at him," he said benevolently, like a man pointing out a dog doing a good trick. "Always got his nose in a book."
He raised his voice.
"Teach, come and show this wizard the way to Hung Hung."
He turned back to Rincewind.
Teach will tell you anything you want to know, because he knows everything. I'll leave you with him. I've got to go and have a talk with old Vincent.
He waved a hand dismissively.
Not that there's anything wrong with him at all, he said defiantly. It's just that his memory's bad. We had a bit of trouble on the way over. I keep telling him it's rape the women and set fire to the houses.
Rape? Said Rincewind.
That's not very... He's 87, said Cohen. Don't go and spoil an old man's dreams.
Teach turned out to be a tall, stick-like man with an amiably absent-minded expression and a fringe of white hair so that, when viewed from above, he would appear to be a daisy. He certainly did not appear to be a bloodthirsty brigand, even though he was wearing a chainmail vest slightly too big for him and a huge scabbard strapped across his back, which contained no sword but held a variety of scrolls and brushes. His chainmail shirt had a breast pocket with three different coloured pens in a leather pocket protector.
"Ronald Savileye," he said, shaking Rincewind's hand. "The gentleman do rather assume considerable knowledge on my part. Let me see. You want to go to Hung Hung, yes?"
Rincewind had been thinking about this. "I want to know the way to Hung Hung," he said guardedly.
"Yes, well, at this time of year, I'd head towards the setting sun until I left the mountains and reached the alluvial plain, where you'll see evidence of drumlins and some quite fine examples of obviously erratic boulders. It's about 10 miles.
Rincewind stared at him. A brigand's directions were usually more along the lines of keep straight on past the burning city and turn right when you've passed all the citizens hanging up by their ears.
"Those drumlins sound dangerous," he said. "They're just a type of post-glacial hill," said Mr. Savileye.
"What about these erratic boulders? They sound like the kind of thing that'd pounce on..."
"Just boulders dropped a long way from home by a glacier," said Mr. Savileye. "Nothing to worry about. The landscape is not hostile."
Rincewind didn't believe him. He'd had the ground hit him very hard many times.
"However," said Mr. Savileye, "Hung Hung is a little dangerous at the moment."
"No, really?" said Rincewind wearily.
"It's not exactly a siege. Everyone's waiting for the Emperor to die. These are what they call here," he smiled, "interesting times."
"I hate interesting times." The other hoarders had wandered off, fallen asleep again, or were complaining to one another about their feet. The voice of Cohen could be heard somewhere in the distance.
"Look, this is a match, and this is..."
"You know, you sound a very educated man for a barbarian," said Rincewind.
"Oh, dear me, I didn't start out a barbarian. I used to be a school teacher. That's why they call me Teach."
"What do you teach?"
"Geography. And I was very interested in Oriental."
The Ankh-Morpork name for the counterweight continent and its nearby islands. It means place where the gold comes from.
"Studies. But I decided to give it up and make my living by the sword."
"After being a teacher all your life?"
"It did mean a change of perspective, yes."
"But, well, surely the privation, the terrible hazards, the daily risk of death?" Mr. Savileye brightened up.
"Oh, you've been a teacher, have you?"
Rincewind looked around when someone shouted. He turned to see two of the horde arguing nose to nose. Mr. Savileye sighed.
"I'm trying to teach them chess," he said. "It's vital to the understanding of the Oriental mind, but I am afraid they have no concept of taking turns at moving, and their idea of an opening gambit is for the king and all the pawns to rush up the board together and set fire to the opposing rooks."
Rincewind leaned closer.
"Look, I mean, Genghis Cohen," he said. "Has he gone off his head? I mean... just killing half a dozen geriatric priests and nicking some paste gems, yes. Attacking 40,000 guards all by himself is certain death."
"Oh, he won't be by himself," said Mr. Savileye.
Rincewind blinked. There was something about Cohen. People caught optimism off him, as though it was the common cold. "Oh, yes, of course. Sorry, I'd forgotten that. 7 against 40,000. I shouldn't think you'll have any problems. I'll just be going... fairly quickly, I think."
"We have a plan,"
It's a sort of...
Mr. Savaloy hesitated, his eyes unfocused slightly.
You know, thing. Bees do it. Wasps, too. Also some jellyfish, I believe. Had the word only a moment ago. Ugh, it's going to be the biggest one ever, I think.
Rincewind gave him another blank stare. I'm sure I saw a spare horse, he said.
Let me give you this, said Mr. Savaloy. Then perhaps you'll understand. It's what it's all about, really.
He handed Rincewind a small bundle of papers fastened together by a loop of string through one corner. Rincewind, shoving it hastily into his pocket, noticed only the title on the first page. It said, What I Did on My Holidays.